Hi, this is Steve Worona, and you're listening to EDUCAUSE Live. Before I introduce today's guest, here's a brief orientation to the technology we're using, which is an interface called Horizon Wimba Open Room. Your browser right now is showing the title slide for today's talk. In the lower left-hand corner of your screen is the word to, followed by a colon, and then a drop-down list currently displaying the word all. To the right of that drop-down list is a blank line where you can type a message. To send a message to the general chat area, first make sure the drop-down list does still say all, and then type your message into the blank line and hit enter. And that's how you'll ask a question or make a comment during today's session. Just send it to the general chat area, and we'll respond to as many of your messages as we can over the course of the hour. You can also send a private message to anyone else that's logged on. To do that, just select the recipient from the drop-down list before typing your message. One of the names you'll find in that list right now is Horizon Help. If you run into any technical problems, send a private message to that name and they'll assist you. And finally, if you missed part of today's conversation, or if you want to see some or all of it again, all EDUCAUSE Live events are archived on the EDUCAUSE Live website, including both the audio and video. Feel free to come back as often as you like. We'll also have a copy of our speaker's slides linked from the EDUCAUSE Live webpage. And today we have two speakers from the University of Texas to talk about identity federation. We'll be hearing first from Claire Goldsmith, Associate Vice Chancellor and CIO of the University of Texas System. Claire's office provides IT and communication support for the UT System Administration and oversees statewide telecommunications network services and the UT Digital Library. As Chair of the Strategic Leadership Council, Claire develops system-wide IT policy and strategic plans. Before taking on his current job, Claire held high-level IT positions at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, the University of Texas at Austin, the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, and Advanced Software Technologies. He's currently a member of the InCommon Steering Committee and received his bachelor's, master's, and doctorate in electrical engineering from Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. Claire?
Thank you, Steve. And welcome to all of you. I started to say good morning, good noon, and good afternoon, depending on where you all are. I'm talking today about governance in identity management federations, and it's reasonable that we begin with a definition of governance, which we got from the Institute on Governance, and there really is such an entity, and it is the process through which a group of people make decisions that direct their collective efforts. That will come back to us, and it's good to keep it in mind as we go through these first theoretical sort of discussion here about governance. First of all, that governance is a time-consuming process. It's complicated by all the stakeholders. Notice that we said in the definition, people make decisions that direct their collective efforts, so it inherently contains a feedback loop, which means that it can, be unstable, I suppose, in different times. Theoretically and basically, it should focus on the strategic aspects of decision-making. That's how we get the most out of our governance structure. So why do we need it? Well, first of all, there's always going to be conflicts and conflict resolutions. One could say that you need it to manage agreements, but in the federation context, we really say that it's to establish and manage trust agreements. Then there is a strategy comes back into it with determining direction and setting policy. Finally, to ensure services meet the business needs while having security and compliance with legal requirements. I don't know about all of you all, but currently in my institution or institutions, audit and compliance are two of the biggest things that we're dealing with. In fact, some of our institutions actually now have people on staff who deal only with audits. And then finally, to establish and communicate operational standards and processes. That's how we know whether or not we're doing the job we set out to do. So if you don't have governance, what is the alternative? First of all, it's a collection of one-to-one agreements, and this is similar to what you see in your daily lives in dealing with all of your vendors. I mean, certainly you have all these contracts or agreements that could govern your relationship with them. However, in the idea of having trust and a group of entities that do trust one another, it would be difficult to establish agendas, and it would be unlikely that you would have any kind of a common goal. There would be difficult to reach agreement on technology standards, and there would be inconsistencies in operating practices. And then, of course, the security would be the responsibility of each of the individual entities, and it would be at risk very much as compliance would be. I'm going to talk about a couple of governance models, and the first one here is homogeneous institutions. They are characterized, and that's a group of entities that want to cooperate in a federation that are similar. And so as you go from institution to institution, practices will vary, but their governance policies will be largely consistent, and their legal requirements, their compliance issues, should be similar, if not identical. The considerations around homogeneous institutions is that governance can be fairly tightly structured, more so than with heterogeneous institutions. It may, in fact, have governance already through executive committees or governing boards, and probably does. But key executives also are characterized as making the decisions. If we consider then diverse institutions or heterogeneous institutions, operating in standards and practices will vary. This could be public versus private. Therefore, governance policies will not be consistent. There will be no formal entity to force a decision. And legal requirements may not be similar and will likely vary. Therefore, the considerations show that governance may be more loosely organized, and it will rely on advisory groups to formulate recommendations. Guidance will be provided by oversight or steering committees, and decisions will be more around collegiality as opposed to key executives. As we come to the University of Texas per se, let's just describe it instantly as 16 entities or institutions. There are 9 general academic institutions, there are 6 health institutions, and then an overarching entity called system administration. We think of it as being homogeneous in that the institutions share a common mission. It has the same governance body and consistent policies. That's through the regents and our board of regents, and certainly the same legal requirements, both federal and state. However, it has a quality of diverseness to it in that there are significant differences in size and budgets. MD Anderson's budget will approach $2 billion, and Permian Basin's probably approaches less than $100 million. There's significant differences in culture and how they all work internally. The institutions are relatively autonomous, and which results, of course, in 16 stovepipes.
Claire, thanks for giving us all of that background. You're listening out there to EDUCAUSE Live. We're talking about identity federation and, at the moment, the governance thereof. If you want to ask a question, type it into that blank line next to the all and hit enter, and we will present the questions to our speakers over the course of the hour. And we do have a question. Claire, somebody says, so institutions that include a hospital or healthcare system are heterogeneous because of the burden of HIPAA requirements. Is that right?
Not entirely, but there is always the thought that HIPAA is somehow or other different or special. But in point of fact, there are a number of requirements that entities are, that we are faced with. HIPAA, FERPA, Graham Leach Bliley for financial information having to do with students and so on. So you have to, in your federation, be able to deal with the requirements of protecting all of these various kinds of information.
So are you sort of saying that having looked at what the requirements are from HIPAA and some of these other regulations, even though they might only apply to one kind of institution, it's a good idea to apply them everywhere, and so you sort of turn what might have been heterogeneous into a homogeneous situation?
To some extent, because it turns out that even in our general academic institutions, there are portions of them that will be covered by HIPAA. And in fact, system administration, which is all administration, right, is covered by HIPAA, because we have all of the health insurance processing.
Uh-huh.
And so we have to deal with it here.
Now, when you were starting to talk about governance and you started talking about stakeholders, what I was hearing sounds like the quote-unquote normal kinds of conversations that you have on an individual campus, that you have to deal with stakeholders, you have to deal with different sized departments, different kinds of people with different kinds of power. How does the cross-organizational governance problem compare to what one has to do on just a single campus?
I would say that there is a lot that the campus experience does to inform what we're doing system-wide. But that's because we're doing it system-wide for the University of Texas. If you look at federations that span diverse organizations in that maybe one's public and one's private, then there may be other issues that you'll have to confront as well, such as the applicability of certain laws.
And that actually gets me to another question I was going to ask, which is, as you've just gone through talking about the University of Texas, how applicable would you say are the lessons that you've learned and the lessons that you're going to be describing to other kinds of institutions, other kinds of systems?
I think they're very apropos, and we are more than willing to share our experiences with others and the documents that we have generated as a result of this experience. And I almost all, as you pointed out, even what we're doing at the federation level or at the statewide level with the University of Texas is applicable to a single campus. And in fact, the University of Texas at Austin is doing similarly within that campus what we're doing at the system level. And we just stay in contact, and what we're doing guides what they're doing to some extent.
So lessons of greater applicability than one might at first think.
That's right.
Okay, let me let you get back to your presentation at slide 8.
Okay. What we're going to talk about here is governance models in shibboleth federations. And just what we did was looked at a continuum from left to right of the most diverse set of institutions. And if for those of you that are experienced with trying to look at some of the federations out there, NQ was the federation that people could just join at Internet 2 and experiment. There wasn't any real trust involved at all. Then secondarily, you have In Common, which is trying to deal with the issue of these diverse institutions, in other words, all of higher ed. And then we believe that we're to the right of that, that we're more homogeneous, because principally the reason we set out to do our own federation is because we are under a single board. And that does permit us to interact without some of the agreements that might be necessary in other situations. And on the far right is a newcomer to the game. This is the EOF Federation. This is the federal government. And I will right up front say that this is the caveat associated with this diagram is this is the University of Texas's perception of the relative homogeneity of these four federations. They might have a different perception. Now, if we focus on the UT System Identity Management Federations, let me just tell you where we are right now. It is true, as the slide says, that the Test Identity Management Federation exists. And initially it is for UT institutions only. I will say that the slide is a tad out of date. We have a go-live of September 1st, but for all intents and purposes, all the approvals have been received and the Federation is live as we speak. The board has been appointed. All of the policy documents are created. As I said earlier, it operates under the authority of the UT System Board of Regents. And if we look at some of the applications, I'll just describe five of them here. We started with an application which was the guest wireless network at the central office. And the interesting thing about the central office is that it has a lot of meetings that involves the other people from the other institutions. They invariably want to bring their laptops and do email back home. So our first project was to bring up wireless, and we do have a wireless authentication using their home credentials for visitors at the system buildings. We also have a project which was called, or is called, the Monthly Financial Report. This is what is interesting because it also at least involves one person from each of the 15 institutions who has to file this report monthly. And it was a great application to have because, as I said, it only required one person at each institution. It did not require thousands. There is a shibboleth version of Blackboard at the UT Health Science Center at Houston. It provides courses from the Health Science Center to students at MD Anderson, which is located, both of these entities are located in Houston in the medical complex there. And that has interesting application, which Bill maybe will talk about a little later. There is another project, which is just an inventory application to try to encourage collaboration across the institutions by having an inventory of research activities that are ongoing. Then there's the timesheet application, which Facilities Planning and Construction is the entity that manages all of the buildings, all of the building and construction on all 15 campuses. And so that is a remote application as well. There is another application, and it doesn't involve us as it involves only UT Austin, but they have set up, what do they call it? It's with a vendor that students use to get information about on their mobile phones. It's basically a coupon that gets sent to your mobile phone that says, half price off pizzas for the next 20 minutes, and so everybody goes roaring down the street to the pizza place. And that is a SHIBD application as well. I think it's called Mobile Campus, but I'm not sure of the name. Well, the question is, how do you get here? And in other words, what is needed? And it's the sorts of things that you're sort of what you're used to. It's, you need to have a vision as to where you want to go, what you're trying to accomplish. You need to know if there are business drivers that make this even feasible. And once that's on paper and concrete, you have to have a plan. The plan is useful to getting executive buy-in, and that gets you some funding. It's a continual process, and this is a loop. You just loop back on these three things and keep going back through them to improve the Federation. Let's look at governance now in the context of the UT System Identity Management Federation. What you see is the across the top is the UT system, and that should probably say Information Technology Strategic Leadership Council, because that's really what it is, It's a group I chair. It generally is the CIOs of the 15 institutions who come together quarterly. And as you can see on the left-hand side where it says representation, that's from the institutions themselves. The institutions all are represented on the Strategic Leadership Council. Its general function is to create strategies and IT management principles and policies that the institutions all agree to. What the Strategic Leadership Council has done, if you look at the arrow going down that says board membership to the UT System ID Management Federation Board, the Strategic Leadership Council appoints that board for all intents and purposes. Some of the people are members of the Strategic Leadership Council, some of them are not. They are major stakeholders. The board was also empowered by a statement of direction that you can find on our website and is instructive as to, it was a very simple sort of thing, but probably a half page that all 15 institutions could agree to. Well, as you come to the more or less the end of my poor presentation on governance, some things to think about, and I will just run through these very quickly. But the first one up here you'll see says the technical implementation aspects of the Federation can get way ahead of policy and governance. That was certainly our experience. Getting everything through the Office of General Counsel and so on was not trivial. And governance sometimes gets tangled up with power and autonomy. And the two bullets here say priorities vary by institution. And sometimes when you're just trying to establish a convention, it may be seen as a dictate. And one of the technical problems where this comes up is, where do you prefer Active Directory or LDAP? Now, everybody has all their reasons for doing those sorts of things, but we had one institution who could never get off the AD kick, and but as time has passed, they have seen the light. Now that, like the rest of us, do both. Managing trust relationships, you will find, is complex, even when dealing with our institutions, and complexity increases, we believe, as the diversity of the membership increases. Other issues to ponder: indemnification. What happens when something goes wrong? This is a very tough issue and requires an awful lot of thought. We have all of these federations have either dealt with it or at least confronted it. And then finally, the newest one, because of, as you can see, the UT has its own federation, in common as a federation, the Fed has a federation. The question is, can these federations interoperate? Now we're talking about interfederation trust agreements. We are just now breaking the ground on that. We have people participating in that, but it is something that will impact federations as we go forward.
Claire, thanks. I'm intrigued by the indemnification question. To the extent that all of the parties involved in this federation are part of UT, is it really the case that one part of UT has to indemnify another?
No, it isn't, but we are also trying to keep our agreements as much in line with in common as we can, so that the trust, so that the interfederation agreements between in common and the UT Federation would be easy to do, or at least possible to do.
I understand. We have a question. Is MFR access based on role or on name?
It's based.
You may be able to guess who asked that question, Claire. It came from David Wadsley. Thank you, David.
At this point, it's based on the institutional identifier, and so it's based really on what's essentially a name.
We have a question that I think refers back to slide 12, so I'm going to put that slide back up on the screen. And the question is, what do each of these three groups focus on more specifically? And I'm assuming the question deals with the Strategic Leadership Council, the institutions, and the Federation Board.
Okay. The Federation Board is the entity that developed all of the policy and had people who were really interested in dealing with the policy issues that came from and were representative from the representative of the institutions. And so the kinds of things that you'll deal with there is what's your process for vetting individuals on your campus, and how can we make that something that Institution A can trust Institution B's process, because that's what you're asking people to do. And so the board tried to come up with a set of policies that would in fact do that, and then they turn that over to the Strategic Leadership Council, who in fact has the authority, more or less, to say that this is how we're going to operate across all of the institutions, which is what the box is on your left, and that box represents the 15 entities, the nine general academic institutions and the six health institutions.
So is it fair to say that the Federation Board is sort of setting policy, setting strategy, and the Leadership Council is a little closer to the implementation?
No, it's the other way around.
Oh.
And as a matter of fact, well, they're both, in effect, policy organizations, but the Strategic Leadership Council worries about all things IT with respect to the University of Texas system, whereas the Federation Board is only concerned with things related to the Federation. The Council just simply did not have a mechanism to take this on. It doesn't have enough time or staff. These are 15 CIOs, some of which are extremely busy. And so in order to have an entity that had the time and the expertise, we had to create the board.
Got it. We'll have more time for questions for Claire Goldsmith at the end, but right now we're going to switch to our second speaker. Thanks a lot, Claire. Our second speaker is Bill Weems. Bill is the Assistant Vice President of Academic Technology at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston, as well as the Associate Dean of Information Technology and an Associate Professor in the Integrative Biology and Pharmacology Department at the UT Houston Medical School. His research interests include the neurophysiology of sympathetic prevertebral ganglia, the production and I love saying this stuff, Bill, the production and control of intestinal motility and propulsion, and informatics as a research tool in the study, characterization, and management of complex systems. Bill's been involved for a number of years in the development of middleware for integrated applications, the use of electronic publishing, the integration of academic and healthcare information systems at the application layer, and the establishment of the University of Texas System PKI and the UT System Identity Management Federation. Bill co-chairs the EDUCAUSE Identity Management Working Group and is a member of the UT System Identity Management Federation Board. Bill?
Thank you, Steve. What I'd like to do is to pick up where Claire has sort of left off from the policy procedure and really begin to look at how all of this translates into some very real issues. If we take a look really at what the collaborative goal of the entire aspect of federations is, really to make the sharing of restricted resources both within an organization and across organizational boundaries as transparent to users as really accessing public web pages. Now, as we all know, it's really a hassle in the sense that if you need to go from, say, and we'll be talking about here to a large extent, us, the Health Science Center Houston, and MD Anderson, because we really are so close, we have physicians that are part of our residency program at the Health Science Center. Our Blackboard system, as Claire alluded to, is being used to provide a number of courses to MD Anderson. And so really what you would like to do is to have some easy way of allowing people across these organizational boundaries to have access to things that they really have the privileged right to get to. So if we take a look really at sort of the identity management, and this concept of a credential is really, I think, one of the key things that oftentimes we miss as we try to help people come to grips with this whole thing. Ideally, I think we would find that most individuals would like a single digital credential that could be securely used to authenticate his or her identity anytime authentication of identity is required to access some particular process or transaction. So if we take a look really at what a federated credential is, it really allows a person to use his or her federated identity credential for a single sign-on access to a restricted service and service applications provided by other Federation members for which she has privileges. One of the things that we find people get really confused on is that they just simply say, well, this is just a password that we're talking about. This is a username password. But all the policy and procedure things that Claire was talking about is really what makes this a credential, in the sense that if we take a look at what ideally a digital credential must do, is that when it is presented to someone for a whole variety of reasons, or presented to a system, say example, somebody at Anderson accesses our Blackboard system and they want to take a course that's being offered on that Blackboard system for them to work with. Well, first of all, we need to positively identify that person. And to do that, we need to have the credential in such a way that it can include the person's permanent identifier so that we really do know who the certifying authority is, such that we could get back to, let's say, that bag of protoplasm that happens to be Claire Goldsmith at the University of Texas System. And it's really this ability to be able to identify in a very secure way with this credential that we're dealing with someone and we can really trust the fact that the credential agency, in this case each of the members of the UT System Federation, are responsible for providing these credentials that then can be used by people to share resources across the entire system. Clearly, it needs to be presented only by the person that authenticates, so if you've got really a reasonable, strong level of vetting and credentialing, this should reach certain standards. Ideally, it should be tamper-proof and would be in some of the others, some of the higher levels we'll talk about in a moment, and ideally could be accepted by all systems. One of the things we need to consider a bit here, again, that people get lost about when they just think of things as passwords, is what is identity? And really, there's sort of two categories of identity that we're finding that you have to deal with. One is really that physical identity, that is the bag of protoplasm that's presenting the credential to a system. Has that individual been identified in such a way that we really know that it is Claire Goldsmith? And we do that now a number of ways. Facial picture is oftentimes the most common thing that we do in universities. It could, in theory, be fingerprints, and maybe sometime in the future it might even be DNA samples. But we would like to really know that the individual is an entity that can be re-identified anytime that credential is put in place. The other thing that falls into this are a whole list of identity attributes, which oftentimes are referred to as authorization attributes, in that they are not necessarily just unique to one individual, but are attributes that a unique individual has that may very well be allowed to, may be there to allow people to get into systems. For example, let's say that somebody at Anderson wants to get into our Blackboard system, and we would like the system to do self-provisioning. So if we use Shibboleth, and the person authenticates to Shibboleth to our Blackboard system, and when they do that, the handshake occurs such that the attribute authority at Anderson says that Jane Doe really has a EduPerson entitlement to allow them to access a particular course or to access our Blackboard system, then ideally the Blackboard system can provision itself automatically to put this person in the course based upon attributes that were determined by people at Anderson. And that would be and is potentially a very useful thing for us here, because we host courses that are actually Anderson courses, but we host them on our Blackboard system. If we go to really the next slide and take a look at this whole identity vetting credentialing process, all of this really relates to the idea that there's got to be an identity provider, one of the 15 or actually 16 UT institutions, that identity provider obtains the physical characteristics of some individual, some person, and then assigns to that individual an everlasting identifier, and that identifier then is permanently bound to the person and stored in an identity database that persist with the certifying authority. And then associated with the individual is this digital credential that when it is presented in theory to another relying system or even possibly as a digital signature in an email message, that we have a pretty good idea that it is that same bag of protoplasm that is doing all of these different things, whatever they may be. Now, if we go and take a look at the Health Science Center Identity Management System, you'll see that what each of the institutions has to do and what we have to do here is if you take a look at the top row, we clearly have a human resource management system, a student information system, a graduate medical information system, guest, et cetera. And that it is this system that we must go through and make sure that if we have people that are in multiple sources of authorities, they may be both a student and both an employee, that in essence they will be put into our directory service as one particular entity. And then the authentication service and the authorization service is there to provide both authentication as well as various identity attributes that can be utilized by a relying service, in case of the example we're talking about this morning, the Health Science Center Blackboard, to in essence allow people to begin to take courses on that particular system.
So, Bill, the diagram that we've been looking at on slide 8 just refers to your one institution. We're not dealing with any federation yet, and this looks complex enough to deal with in your institution. One of the things on Claire's slide was business cases, business factors, business drivers. Tell me a little more about what's driving UTHSC at Houston to want to federate with the rest of the UT system.
Well, actually, a number of things. We'll start, again, we're just talking about with Anderson. As I sort of mentioned earlier, is that we have a residency program that has tens of physicians who are physicians at Anderson that, in essence, are part of the educating faculty for those residents. And what we have been doing up to this particular point in time, clearly because of HIPAA requirements, privacy requirements, et cetera, for somebody at Anderson to be part of our system, we have had to identify them as the Health Science Center, meaning that those people have had to come across, and if you're looking at slide 8 there, they've had to be registered as guests in our system. As you can imagine, that's not something you'd like to have to do for every application in UT system that you might want to share. But in lieu of doing something like a federation, then you're stuck to meet compliance and policy issues that Claire alluded to earlier, that somebody has to take the responsibility for identifying and credentialing those individuals. And the nice thing about the federation is that you can use the process that is at each home institution to go about getting that done. That then makes this sharing of resources hopefully as easy as looking at public web pages.
Let me get some idea of quantification, and we do have a question that's come in, and I will get to that in a second. But give me an idea of the number of users, the number of individuals who, in the old model, you would have had to give guest access to, you'd have had to process specially, that now sort of just sort of flow through seamlessly, or at least have the potential of flowing through seamlessly, given the Federation?
Well, to give you an idea, in terms of active guests that we have right now at the Health Science Center just to do business, we have roughly 1,500 individuals. So those are people that are not officially affiliated with the university because of contracts or other things we have needed to identify. With Anderson, where we hope to get is that we have roughly about 3,000 people at Anderson that have previously had to have guest accounts, and we would like, in essence, to get all 3,000 of those such that they're using their home credentials as opposed to having to go through this fairly onerous process of getting guest credentials.
And Claire, do you see the same sorts of scaling taking place throughout the UT system? I mean, the idea is that each campus, without the federated system, would somehow have to be provisioning on an exception basis, on a guest basis, for thousands and thousands of individuals, and that's now going to smooth out?
Yes, that's very, very much so. And sometimes the distances where you're talking about sharing of courses and so on is such that this, the manual process or the legacy process, I guess, is just has all sorts of holes in it. Like people leave, and the hosting institution knows that, but the institution that's providing the course never gets the word.
Right, a problem that that we've been confronting in higher ed IT for years and years.
It'll
be wonderful to have solved it. Bill, I'm going to hit you with one more question, then let you get back to your presentation, and we will have time at the end to get to these other questions that are building up. And the question, Bill, is what was the process you used to assign a UUID to existing users of multiple applications?
Say that again, Steve.
What was the process you used to assign a UUID to existing users of multiple applications?
Okay. As slide 8 shows, everybody that is in our institution, whether they are faculty, students, staff, or if they are in our guest database, automatically gets issued a UUID. And how that happens is that in this process you see in the middle, on some of it in real time, all of it, what's not in real time is every 24 hours, takes a look to find out, for example, if somebody started off as a student in the Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences, they then become an employee, so they show up in the Human Resource Management System. The reconciliation process that is there determines that that really is the same individual, and the individual already does have a UUID. And so they are just simply added as being affiliated with an attribute that they're affiliated with another source of authority. If they've been here before, because our person registry is permanently keeping those UUIDs, and somebody comes back 4 or 5 years later, the system recognizes that they have been here before and just picks up that UUID and runs with it.
Thanks. Back to your prepared presentation at slide 9.
Okay. Just sort of as a review to everyone, one of the things where I think the feds have been a help to us is that under the e-authentication initiative, they've actually kicked out 4 levels of assurance that I won't go into what the details are here. Most of the stuff that we're working with right now with the UT System Federation, we're doing at level 2. We are doing some level 1 stuff, but that is actually not where the key efforts primarily are. And I just sort of wanted to remind everybody that there is this nice credential assessment framework, which sort of gives us some guidance as to how we might want to go about playing the game. If we go to the next slide and take a look at sort of what's entitled Federated Services here, you see, in fact, that we have in blue the representations of various identity providers. These are actually for what might be in common, as well as the UT System Federation. And you see there then in sort of the sandy colored ovals, we have 3 possible services that people might need to get to. And what I'd like to talk about are just some real new issues that we have found now as we begin to play in this space, that we begin to deal with Blackboard. And if you go to the next slide, what you would find is that if you were to log into the Health Science Center Blackboard system, you would see the login page that is located there. And currently, it is set up where there are two buttons on it, one which if you click on, you would just use directly our LDAP authentication process. If you click on the UT System Federation button, then you actually go through SHIB. So if you're at Anderson or at UTEP or at UTMB and you need to take one of our courses, what you would do is you would click on the UT System Federation button. Actually, that button will work for all the people here now also. We're in the process of upgrading our Blackboard system, and in just a couple of weeks, our Blackboard system will be using Shibboleth straight out for everybody, and so we won't really have this issue. If you click on that UT System Federation button, I think most of you are familiar probably enough with what Shibboleth does, so it would take you to the University of Texas System's WAIF, and you would see there that it asks you to choose from this pull-down list, and if you click on that pull-down list, what you find is all 16 UT System institutions there. And if you're, say, at Anderson, as we were talking about, and you wanted to get to our Blackboard system, you would pick Anderson. What I have picked for the next example is if you were to take the UT Austin as the home institution, you would see the IDP authentication page that comes from UT Austin. And I picked it because there's a number of interesting things that you need to be careful here. All 16 institutions here are at very different development stages of their identity management system. A place like UT Health Science Center here in Houston, we've been doing identity management for a long time. Everybody has an idea what their University of Texas Houston user ID and password is. UT Austin is the same way. You'll notice that there at the top, this is a UT EID. Basically, anybody that comes to that page, they already know what the UT EID is at Austin, and they simply fill it in. Now, Austin's done a very nice job that if you look there, it's provided some information as to, if you didn't know what that was, some guidance as to users as to how to get there. The point I want to make is, let's say that we now have other institutions that are wanting to use our Blackboard system. And so student Jane Doe at Institution X is told that all she needs to do is to log on to the UT Houston Blackboard. She does that. She picks her institution from the pull-down menu. She gets a username, password prompt, and she has no idea what to put in. And the reason probably she has no idea as to what to put in is the institution still may not have sort of a common understanding of the fact that there really is now a institutional credentialing process that you would be using for a lot of things. So what we have found that happens, if you take a look at the following slide 15, that a person can't log on to their identity authentication service for a number of reasons. And the first one that gets to be a real problem for a lot of these places is they really don't know what password is being requested. So we need to be sure that when we put together our authentication pages at each of the institutional IDPs, that the page must define which service is requesting the username and password. And as we saw in the previous slide with the UT EID, for their case, everybody pretty much knows what that is there anyway. But even if not, then the login page correctly put together a resource where people can go to and get some help as to what to do. The next one that gets to be a real problem, obviously, is that people can just type their password in incorrectly. And these systems should be set up in such a way that if you type it in, that it says authentication fails, and you can go about and re-enter the password. What we have found in some instances are that people really haven't used a web page as such for the authentication process. They get a little JavaScript window, and that gets to be really somewhat frustrating to people because they're at an institution and they really have no idea what's going on. The next slide brings up the other really important thing that we've stumbled on that we're going to have to start to think about in this instance, and this is where the person at Institution A appropriately authenticated, but when they hit our Blackboard system, they're not authorized to get into our Blackboard system. They were authenticated, which says, yes, we knew that was James Jackson, but James Jackson really isn't been approved for a course or an organization in our Blackboard system. And so at that particular point, one of the things that we had not done well initially is that we did not have a statement that popped up that clearly said you are not authorized, and it tended to leave the institution, the person in the dark from the requesting institution that they didn't know what to do. So you need for, at that point, to give some guidance as to who the person should contact if they are not, in fact, authorized to get into the system. And that could, in fact, be somebody probably at their home institution. It might be, depending on how you have things set up, to be someone at the service provider institution. And this is something that if you do not get set up and you have tens, if not hundreds, of students trying to get in, it gets to be very, very frustrating because now you're not just dealing with one help desk at one institution. You've got people between two or more institutions trying to get in without knowing how that you go about getting help to resolve this problem. So really basically the solution is to have an error page that gives guidance. The last thing I wanted to just deal with here is the fact that we're going to have to look at how we go about provisioning these services that are requested that we're wanting to go to. How, for example, in Blackboard is a cost provision? One is it could be manual in the sense that you have a Blackboard administrator who gets, say, out of bounds a list of names and person principal names, or let's call it net IDs, from a list that is provided by, say, the source of authority at MD Anderson or some other relying institution, and it's these people that, in essence, should be given privileges to get into the course. Ideally, as Internet2 and EDUCAUSE and others have been working with, is to set up a process where you can automatically provision the system such that the service provider application, say Blackboard, obtains authorization attributes from the home institution of the person that's applying, and from that is capable of provisioning the Blackboard course with the appropriate student information. For that to work, though, you are going to have an awareness of the IT staff at that home institution and the resources made available in such a way that those privilege attributes, those authorization attributes, can be added into the IDP of the home institution's IDP such that the relying, or in our case the Blackboard system, will know that those people are there. So I'll leave with the really interesting issue of how do we go about getting the source of authorities for privileges to remote resources, how do we handle some of them at the service provider institution, and when do they get handled at actually the various home institutions that are trying to access that service.
And Bill, these of course are questions that those of us who've been thinking about federated identity for a while have been scratching our heads over for a while, but the nice thing about you and Claire and the rest of the UT system is you're actually now doing it so that you can help figure out what the answers to these things are.
And the thing you should keep in mind is if you don't have them figured out, people get frustrated very quickly.
We've got to go ahead.
and it accelerates up to upper administration fast.
We've got a couple of questions that came in on slide 8, so I'm going to put that slide back up. The first question, in the reconciliation process, did you write your own search and match logic or leverage some commercial APIs?
We wrote our own.
And I'll ask the obvious next question, would you make that available? Would that be applicable at other places?
Yes, it is applicable, and actually we have made it available through some of the NMI camps and others, and we would be more than happy to make that available.
Another question in the same context, universities often need to associate identities with individuals they only quote-unquote lightly know, prospective students, donors they may not want to ask for driver's licenses, etc. Does your system allow tracking and transmission of the level of assurance with which someone has been identity vetted?
Yes, actually, if you take a look at the guidelines or the policies and procedures of the UT Federation Board, we have a UT assurance level that is an attribute that can at this point be set at either level 1 or level 2, since really that's the ones that we're working with. And it will be that particular assurance level that gives us an idea of what we're dealing with on the trust fabric.
And that segues to another question that came in that I'm going to address to Claire. And the question is, at what level of assurance does your federation operate, 1 through 4?
The goal is to get it to 3. Our intention is to operate it at 3.
But as we've seen, there are different levels of assurance for different kinds of people and at different institutions. How do you deal with this heterogeneity?
Well, but that's different. What the applications are doing is certainly different from what the Federation can do.
Why don't you explain that a little more to people who haven't been living in this space?
The Federation can operate at level 3 or 4 and certainly pass attributes, which is why we were just talking about the level of assurance associated with a given credential, because it can certainly pass the fact that something is that a credential has only level 1 or level 2 assurance, but the Federation per se can operate at a higher level.
So is the following description correct? That is, the Federation needs to operate at least at as high a level as any of the applications that the
yes.
Federation is fronting, because if it didn't, then you would lose trust along the way. And as long as the Federation is operating at a sufficiently high level, each of the campuses, each of the applications on the campuses, each of the credentialing processes can choose the appropriate level up to and including the Federation level.
That's correct. That is correct.
Claire, the heterogeneity that you spent most of your time dealing with was policy-type heterogeneity.
Right.
But as we've seen from Bill's presentation, there's a lot of technology heterogeneity.
Yes.
How is that all playing out in the UT Federation?
Well, it's interesting. For instance, Bill talked about the INDIS program that they have written and use to do the reconciliations. We have used a Microsoft program, MIIS, to do provisioning, and because we get multiple feeds at system administration, and our institutions do as well, and so is we have used that particular piece of technology. And all I'm telling you really is that we have been able to do some to support multiple vendor products in the Federation per se. Some institutions want to run the LDAP as their principal directory services. Others are more likely to run Active Directory and access it with the LDAP APIs for the needs of the Federation. I'm trying to think what else we have used.
Well, maybe we can leave it there for now and invite
yeah.
people to ask questions if they have further, because you and the rest of the UT system are definitely breaking ground that I'm sure lots of other campuses around the country are going to want to track. Thanks very much, Claire and Bill, and thanks to all of our viewers and questioners all over the Internet. You'll shortly be receiving an email asking for your reactions and comments on this EDUCAUSE Live presentation. Please take a minute to reply to that message when it arrives. If you missed any part of today's event, or if you'd like to watch some or all of it again, you'll find both the audio and video in the EDUCAUSE Live archives later today, and you'll also find today's slides linked from the webpage for this EDUCAUSE Live session. The next EDUCAUSE Live will take place on Wednesday, August 2nd, from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. My guests will be Vincent Rowe and Andrew Chusevsky. They're both intelligence analysts with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and they're going to be speaking about trends in malicious code on the Internet. We hope you'll be on hand for that talk. EDUCAUSE Live is a production of EDUCAUSE, the Higher Education IT Association. Our executive producer is Cynthia Golden. Special thanks today to Lida Larson. This is Steve Worona. See you next time on EDUCAUSE Live.